65, we looked at the following aspects of the Hampton Court Conference. Number one, we looked at the historical significance of it. We did that in Lesson 154. We looked at the date in Lesson 154, and we looked at different accounts of the meeting in Lesson 154. Then last Sunday in Lesson 155, we looked at the attendees, and we focused our attention on three key figures. John Reynolds, who we'll see more from today, Richard Bancroft, and then King James himself, all of which are going to be key figures in what we're going to be talking about as we go through today's material. So today in Lesson 156, I want to look at the circumstances surrounding the decision to translate the King James Bible at Hampton Court in 1604. So a lot of things we've been talking about have kind of been building towards this point right here, okay? And I've tried to create at least a little bit of interest and anticipation for this because I think this is the most significant critical point in the whole thing, and that is the moment the decision is made to translate the Bible and what would ultimately become the King James Bible. So, Hampton Court, the decision to translate, I'm right here. I have a note there in italics. The point of this lesson is not to set forth all the details of what transpired at Hampton Court Conference. For our purposes, we will limit our comments to those aspects of Hampton Court that aid with understanding the history of the English Bible. I could spend easily two more lessons on going through the whole litany of everything that happened there. Our focus from the beginning has been to look at those aspects that deal with and tell us about what happened when the decision was made to translate the Bible. Now, there's other things of interest there that you guys could check out if you want to. There's links to the Sum and Substance by Barlow in these notes when they go live. But I'm only going to be focusing on the issues related to the decision to translate the Bible here in this lesson. Okay? So, by 1604, there were two Bibles vying for acceptance in England, the Geneva and the Bishops. So, that's a point that we've made over and over and over again up to today. So, just stating that right out of the gate. Originally published in 1560, the New Testament only in 1557, the English exiles seeking to escape persecution under the reign of Bloody Mary, the Geneva Bible was the Bible of the Puritans and the most popular among the people of England. Okay? So, you have the Geneva. The Geneva, as you know, came from where? So there's two points here. This is first the Bible of the Puritans, and second, this is the Bible of the people. So the people who had a Bible in their home and were using it for their own independent Bible reading and study, what was their Bible of choice? Their Bible of choice was the Geneva Bible, not the Bishop's Bible, right? So if you can picture a common Englishman at that time having a Bible in his house that they were reading from, the chances are very high that it was the Geneva Bible. This was the Bible of the Puritans, and it was the Bible of the everyday common Englishman. That was their Bible of choice. Okay, look at the next point. At the same time, the Bishop's Bible, 1568, was the official Bible of the Church of England. A fact that highlights the popularity of the Geneva over the Bishop's is that all the biblical allusions / quotations found in the plays of William Shakespeare came from the Geneva Bible, not the bishops. So the competitor was the bishops. Now, we've already studied these Bibles in great detail in the last term of this class. We went through every one of them. I taught multiple lessons on each one. We explained them all. If you're just joining us with this lesson, 156, you're going to want to go back and look at all that previous information to really get a good footing an understanding of some of this background. So, by the time of the Hampton Court Conference in 1604, England was in the uncomfortable position of using two different Bibles. Further complicating matters was the reality that the situation had become political. The Puritans, who wanted further reforms to the Church of England, as evidenced by the millenary petition, favored the Geneva. Meanwhile, the high churchman present at Hampton Court favored the bishops. So again, that we've talked about that already, right? So this is the Bible of the Anglican established church. The Geneva is the Bible of the Puritans and the people. So the high churchmen are favorable to which Bible? The bishops, if you went to an Anglican church service, what was the Bible read in the church service? It was the bishops, right? On the second day of the meeting, Monday, January 16, 1604, the Puritans were called to stand before King James. So, stop there. That was that four-group contingency that we talked about last Sunday, right? I had that table, and I showed you all the people that we know were at the meeting, and we observed that only four of them were Puritans. We talked about how those four that stood before the king that day were moderates, that there were more radical or more extreme Puritans that were having their own meeting at the same time, and that these four moderate guys were the ones chosen by the king to come and present the cause of the Puritans at the meeting. Okay? Now, at the end of the day, so this is at the end of day two, after being excoriated up one side and down the other by James, at the tail end of a list of suggestions, seemingly out of nowhere, Reynolds dropped the first seed of the King James Bible. Accounts vary somewhat, but Reynolds is reported to have said, so if you're following along, I'm at the top of page two. Let's look at the first one. Nicholson reports, "May your majesty be pleased that the Bible be new translated." Or newly translated. I think that's right, new. Okay? And then we have another account, "Moved His Majesty," talking about Reynolds, "that there might be a new translation of the Bible, because those which were allowed in the reigns of Henry VIII and Edward VI were corrupt and not answerable to the truth of the original." Okay? Now, let's understand. So, first of all, there is no mention in the millenary petition of the desire for a new Bible. Second, there is zero evidence on anything that had been submitted to the king before this meeting that the Puritans desired a new Bible. They have stood before the king for virtually the entire day arguing or pleading for what the further reforms that they want to see, and the king has basically said, no, 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 no. Probably much more sternly and firmly than I just said, but he's basically shut down everything that they've asked for. And then Reynolds floats this idea, "May your majesty be pleased that the Bible be new translated." And then he says, "Move your majesty that there might be a new translation of the Bible, because those which were allowed in the reigns of Henry VIII and Edward VI were corrupt and not answerable to the truth of the original." So that's what Reynolds said. Now, he's talking about the reign of Henry VIII, right? He's talking about Bibles that were translated then and were available in the reign of his son, Edward VI. Well, what Bible is he talking about? He's talking, guys, about the Great Bible. That was the Bible that was dedicated. Remember, we studied this a lot, that the Great Bible had that massive front page artwork of King Henry handing the Bible down from to all of the different people, his vice regent and the Archbishop of Canterbury, and then down to the people, right? So when he's talking here about the Bible of the reign of Henry VIII and Edward VI, he's talking about which Bible?
The Great
Bible. Now here's the thing. Have at least two translations been done since that time? Since that time, you have the Geneva Bible, which was in 15 what? 60, and you have the bishops from 1568. But in the request, what is Reynolds focusing on? He's focusing on which Bible? The Great Bible. Now you say, why would he do that? Well, let's keep going. It's important to note that Reynolds' request for a new translation appears to have been a complete afterthought. There's no mention of any Puritan misgivings regarding the English Bible in the millenary petition or on the agenda of items submitted to the king before the Hampton Court Conference. So, when they say this, when Reynolds says this, have they said anything up to this point to give any indication at all that they're in any way unhappy with the English Bible? It hadn't even been mentioned, okay? Regarding Reynolds' request, English Bible historian David Norton writes, quote, "This is not one of the topics that Reynolds had said he would raise, and so appears almost as a casual interjection." Likewise, David Thames, author of Majesty, the King Behind the King James Bible, titles his chapter on Hampton Court, quote, "with all the lightness of an afterthought, to capture the apparent flippant nature with which Reynolds appears to have made his request." So is there any evidence at all that he was going to bring this up? It's not even an issue. It's not in the millenary petition. It's not mentioned as something he wants to discuss before the king. He just says it. May it please the king that the Bible be new translated, and then he appeals to the Bible in the reigns of Henry VIII and Edward VI, which is the great Bible, and says, it says there that they were corrupt and not answerable to the truth of the original. Okay? Everybody with me so far? Reynolds, so I'm halfway down page two. Reynolds buttressed his request by citing three passages from the great Bible. 1539. Galatians 4:25. Psalm 105:52 and Psalm 106:30 that he believed were poorly translated. So let's stop there and make sure everybody understands what's going on. So, completely off the cuff, does he say we need a new Bible? Would it please the king to newly translate the Bible? Alright? Then he brings up the Bible in the reign of Henry VIII. And he references the Great Bible. And then he cites three passages from the Great Bible as evidence supporting the idea that there needs to be what? A new translation. Okay? According to William Barlow's account, found in the Sum and Substance, Reynolds stated the following regarding each passage. Now, this we're going to go through somewhat slowly because everyone needs to understand what's going on. So, the first one he brings up is Galatians 4:25. Galatians 4:25. And this is what he says. The Greek word, it's the word that's translated answereth in the King James. So if you get your Bible, so you can see what's going on, go to Galatians chapter 4 and look at verse 25. Galatians chapter 4. Verse 25. So if you read the verse in the King James, it says, "For this Agar is Mount Sinai in Arabia, and answereth to Jerusalem, which now is, and is in bondage with her children." Okay? So you see in your English Bible, in your King James, the word answereth. I mean, Galatians chapter 4, verse 25, everybody sees that word there? Okay? That's the section that Barlow is going to bring up. So go back to your notes. The Greek word, answereth in the King James, is not well translated, as now it is bordereth. So that's what was in the Great Bible. Look underneath. So here's the Great Bible. For Mount Sinai is Agar in Arabia and bordereth. So, what Reynolds is saying is that the Great Bible reading for that verse, where it says bordereth, he says that's a bad what? That's a bad translation. Go back to your notes. The Greek word answereth in the King James is not well translated as now it is bordereth, neither expressing the force of the word, nor the apostle's sense, nor the situation of place. Okay? So I gave you the verse here in the Great Bible so you can see what he's talking about. Is everybody with me so far? Okay? Now look at the Geneva Bible. I gave the Geneva Bible indented here. Here's what the Geneva Bible says. For Mount Sinai is Agar in Arabia. I'm sorry. For Agar or Sinai is a mountain in Arabia. It answereth to Jerusalem, which now is, and she is in bondage with her children. Look at the Bishop's Bible. For Agar is the Mount Sinai in Arabia and bordereth upon the city, which now called Jerusalem, and is in bondage with her children. Okay? So stop there for a minute. What is Reynolds saying? He's saying the Bible of Henry VIII's time, the Great Bible, is poorly translated where it says what? Bordereth. Well, lo and behold, what does the Bishop's Bible say? The same thing. Right? So you can see what's going on here, right? What does the Geneva Bible say?
Answer it.
Okay? Reynolds is a Puritan. Which Bible did he want to use?
Geneva.
He wanted to use the Geneva. Okay? So you see what he's doing. Look at Psalm 105. Psalm 105 verse 28. So we'll go down here. Okay? They were not obedient. The original being, they were not disobedient. So this is the second example that he gives of a poor translation from the time of Henry VIII. Okay? So look at the Great Bible. He sent darkness, and it was dark, and they were not what? Obedient. Okay? So Reynolds is saying, look at the quote, they were not obedient. The original being, they were not what? Disobedient. What did it have in the Great Bible? Obedient. So he's saying that's what? Wrong. Go to top page 3. Geneva. He sent darkness and made it dark, and they were not what? So which Bible has the reading that Reynolds thinks is correct? Which Bible has the reading that Reynolds thinks is correct? The Geneva. So does the Geneva already have the right reading in it according to Reynolds? So why in the world is he bringing up the Great Bible then? Look at the next one. Bishops. He sent darkness, and it was dark, and they went not from his words. Okay? That's what the bishops had there. So understand, in both of the examples that Reynolds brings up of mistakes in the Great Bible and the Bishop's Bible, which one has the correct reading according to Reynolds?
Geneva.
The Geneva. Okay? Look at the third example is from Psalm 106:30. Then stood up Phinehas and prayed, the Hebrew hath executed judgment. Okay? So look at the Great Bible. Then stood up Phinehas and prayed, and so the plague ceased. Look at the Geneva Bible. But Phinehas stood up and did what? Executed judgment, and the plague was stayed. So which version has the correct reading according to Reynolds?
Geneva.
The Geneva. Then look at the bishops. Okay? Then stood up Phinehas. He executed justice. And so the plague ceased. Okay? So Reynolds is being very coy here. He's saying there's three errors. They're not properly translated. Yet for every one of the three passages that Reynolds cites as errors, what Bible already possesses the correct readings according to Reynolds? The Geneva. So I ask you this. Does Reynolds really want a whole new Bible, or does he want the king to just agree to allow them to use the Geneva Bible in the church service? You following me? So he brings up, can we have a new Bible? There's three places in the Bibles of Edward's reign that the readings aren't good. For every one of the three examples that Reynolds brings up from the Great Bible and secondarily from the Bishop's Bible, the correct readings that Reynolds views as correct are already in what Bible? The Geneva Bible. So, look at the next point. Upon further consideration, Reynolds' request not only appears flippant, but also weak. In his account, Barlow states the following regarding the three passages cited by Reynolds. This is from Barlow's Sum and Substance quote. To which motion there was at present no gainsaying, the objections being trivial and old and already what? In print. So if this is Reynolds' big case for why there needs to be a new Bible, Barlow's saying this is a weak what?
Argument.
This is a weak argument. Everybody already knows these things. So and no one's gainsaying the fact that some of these things weren't translated well back here in the Bibles of Edward and Henry's time. So there's no gainsaying. Read it again. Upon further consideration, Reynolds' request not only appears flippant, but also weak. In his account, Barlow states the following regarding the three passages cited by Reynolds. Quote, to which motion there was at present no gainsaying, The objections being trivial and old and also infringed. In other words, the three passages cited by Reynolds to bolster his argument for a new translation did not contain anything that was not already known to those who were present at the meeting. So is he bringing up any earth-shattering new information here? No. Why did Reynolds cite the Great Bible from 1539 when two subsequent English translations existed, namely the 1560 Geneva and the 1568 Bishops? The readings in question cited by Reynolds from the Great Bible were identical to the Bishop's Bible, the official Bible of the Anglican Church, but had been corrected in the 1560 Geneva Bible, the Bible of who? The Puritans. Okay? Reading between the lines, Norton points out the subtle nature of Reynolds' request. By citing these three passages, Reynolds attacked the Bible of the church establishment and offered in its place, as an alternative, the Bible of the Puritans, i.e., the Geneva. According to Norton, quote, Reynolds probably hoped that his suggestion for a new translation would be dismissed and a much simpler solution be followed, adoption of the Geneva Bible as the official Bible of the church. Let's just stop there. For me, I think Norton is absolutely right. What would have been easier to do? Redo the whole Bible? Or just have the king allow them to use the Geneva Bible? You following me? So, in a textual history of the King James Bible, David Norton points out that, quote, if the problem was simply a matter of a few such readings, they might easily be dealt with in the next printing of the Bishop's Bible. Given the fact that the Geneva Bible corrects the three passages cited by Reynolds when compared against the Great and Bishop's Bibles, and that Reynolds offers exactly those readings provided by the Geneva, it appears that the goal of his request was the royal sanctioning of the Geneva Bible for use in public worship in the Anglican Church. And let me say to you, I agree with Norton's analysis, right? When you look at what he's doing, the fact that they don't mention their desire for a new Bible, when they mention it, they bring it up almost as a complete afterthought. When he does bring it up, he cites three passages from the Great Bible that happen to read similarly in the Bishop's Bible, and he offers in its place three corrections that agree 100% with what was already in the Geneva Bible. Okay? So, Barlow's notes, now let's stop right there. So does anybody have any questions or comments you want to ask about all that up to that point?
One question that the top of the page where it says the Geneva says we're not disobedient. Isn't that the opposite translation of what was said in the Great Bible?
Yeah. That's why he thinks the Great Bible is wrong.
Okay. But then the bishops really doesn't. Does that agree with the bishops or not?
In substance, yes. And the other thing, too, is, Bart, when you look at the Bishop's Bible there on the top of page 3, I am quoting there from the 1568 edition, and there may have been a change in a later edition, but I don't have access to the Old Testament text for anything newer than 1568.
One thought I had too was it seemed you were indicating that the conference was going poorly for the Geneva.
Oh, I'm more than indicating that. I'm saying it absolutely was.
Maybe his off-the-hand comment was also appealing to James's ego for a new translation that might accomplish the same thing without actually choosing the Geneva over
the problem I have with what you just said is that no one knows. You know something already because of stuff I've said in previous lessons about James's mindset. The Puritans have no way of knowing that. So when the request is made by Reynolds, he doesn't already know James thinks the Bible needs to possibly be redone. He doesn't know that. All he's doing is looking at the evidence in front of him. And the evidence in front of him suggests, and as I look at it, I agree with David Norton here, that reading between the lines, the obvious implication is that Reynolds, is what he really wants is for the king to just agree to what? Let them use the Geneva Bible in the Anglican church service.
Yeah.
Okay?
But it didn't look like it was going that way, is what I'm seeing. And the suggestion would be a neutral kind of...
Now, James is going to accept that after the fact.
Oh.
But I don't think... That's not Reynolds' motivation for asking.
Okay.
To me, Reynolds' motivation for asking is absolutely to get approval for that Geneva Bible to be used in the service.
Yeah.
He doesn't know James's mindset. And now James is going to see in this an opportunity to accomplish something, but we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. Look at top page 4. Barlow's notes record the reaction of Richard Bancroft, the soon-to-be-named Archbishop of Canterbury. So this was Bancroft's reaction when Reynolds brings up the idea of a new Bible. He said, if every man's humor should be followed, there should be no end of translating. So his reaction is what? Forget it. No way. Okay? The king's response, no doubt, surprised Bancroft and disappointed Reynolds. James supported the notion of a new translation while denying Reynolds' implicit request for the royal sanctioning of the Geneva Bible. Quote, whereupon His Highness wished that some special pains should be taken in that behalf of one uniform translation. Stop there. James doesn't like the fact that there's this political divide. As a politician, he doesn't like it, okay? So he's going to say, okay, we need a uniform translation. Read on. Professing that he could never yet see a Bible well translated in English, but the worst of all His Majesty thought the Geneva to be. So if Reynolds' idea was just give us this, James now steps up and he's like, you're right, we need to have one, but it's not going to be that one. Okay? Professing that he could never yet see a Bible well translated in English, but worst of all, His Majesty thought the Geneva to be, and this to be done by the best learned in both the universities, after them to be reviewed by the bishops and the chief learned of the church, for them to be presented to the Privy Council, and last, to be ratified by His royal authority, and so this whole church to be bound unto it and none other. Mary, withal, he gave this caveat. Upon a word cast out by my Lord of London that no marginal notes should be added, having found in them that which are annexed to the Geneva translation, which he saw in a Bible given him by an English lady, some notes very partial, untrue, seditious, and favoring to much of dangerous and traitorous conceits. As, for example, Exodus 1:19, where the marginal note alloweth disobedience to kings, and 2 Chronicles 15:16, taxeth Asa for deposing his mother, only not killing her. So let's stop there. James says, you're right, let's do that. Let's make a new Bible. It's not going to be the Geneva. That's the worst Bible I've ever seen. The reason it's bad is of these seditious, these partial, untrue, seditious, and favoring much dangerous and traitorous conceits, these notes in the Geneva Bible. This is the worst one I've ever seen. We'll do one, but we're not going to have these kind of marginal notes. That's James's answer. Okay? So did James hate the Geneva Bible? If Reynolds was hoping to just get him to approve this, was he completely shut down?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Okay? But James has another idea. You're right. This isn't a good situation having this division between the Geneva and the Bishop's Bibles. We should have one uniform translation, but we're not going to have a uniform translation like the Geneva, and we're not going to have these seditious and traitorous, marginal notes in it, and that's James' position. Now, here's where this gets real interesting. It turns out that James also believed there needed to be one uniform translation, but he would never sanction or recognize the Geneva on account of its marginal notes that he viewed as seditious and undermining the divine right of kings. According to Adam Nicholson, author of God's Secretaries, the making of the King James Bible, James caught Reynolds' suggestion regarding the official sanctioning of the Geneva Bible and reversed it by answering, yes, I will give you the opposite of what you want. This is all political. So here we see in these moments right here, do we see all of James's ideas about divine right of kings, from the true laws of free monarchies and vassal adorn and all that stuff, is all coming to head right here in this moment where this decision is being made. The request is made implicitly. James realizes what's going on. He's not a dummy. He realizes Reynolds wants what? The Geneva. So he says, yes. Look at Nicholson's wording there. Yes, I'll give you the opposite of what you want. So he says yes to the new Bible, but only it's not going to be anything like what? The Geneva Bible, at least not in the king's mind on how the thing's going to be structured. Because he doesn't like the Geneva Bible. Look at the quote. The translation was to be uniform. In other words, no contentious Geneva-style interpretation set along or within the text. With the learned authority of Oxford and Cambridge, which at least in their upper echelons were profoundly conservative institutions, both of which had sent to the king long and high-flown refutations of every point in the Puritans' millenary petition, to be revised by the bishops, the very influence that Reynolds did not want, then given for goodness sake to the Privy Council, in effect a central censorship committee, with which the governed would ensure that its stamp was on the text, no deviations or subversions allowed, and finally to James himself, whose hostility to any whiff of radicalism this afternoon would be clear, the treasured Geneva Bible would be forced to retreat into the privacy of people's homes and could no longer be used for public reading. So look at, is James, at this point, do we see all of James's kingship and authority coming out to get what he wants?
Yeah.
Okay. Regarding James's decision, David Teams writes, quote, "This was James's icurion, or message of peace, meant to reconcile the differences." In other words, by agreeing to the translation, James had struck a middle path between the Anglicans and the Puritans. James's decision at Hampton Court is precisely in line with the political philosophy he outlined in the True Law of Free Monarchies and Vassal Adorn from the late 1590s. In short, it is quintessential James. So what is James going to do?
I'm going to erase this. He's going to say, I know what to do about this. I'm not going to give either one of them what they want on this. I'm going to make a new one. AV, a new Bible, authorized version of King James. Okay? It's not going to have these notes that are seditious and traitorous that are in the Geneva Bible. We're going to get rid of that. Okay? And then ultimately, what's going to be the base text of this Bible?
Geneva.
Not the Geneva.
The
bishops. The
bishops.
Well, it's going to be censored by the bishops.
So, the base text of it is going to be their Bible. Bishop Bancroft, as we'll see next week, is going to be the one that writes the rules. And these guys aren't going to be able to have any of their precious marginal notes that are going to be controversial. But in doing this, is he going to force people from both groups now, though, to work together to make this? You see what I'm saying? This decision is completely in line with the middle path philosophy of governance that was adopted by Queen Elizabeth first and secondarily by King James.
Now, did the bishops' Bible have marginal notes too?
Very, very few.
Oh, okay. Is that a bad thing to not have the marginal notes?
Well, it depends on your point of view, I suppose, and the nature of the marginal notes. I mean, I obviously have a Scofield Bible here. It's got all kinds of notes in it. I rarely, if ever, even pay attention to them anymore. But there are going to end up, we'll see this next time, there are going to end up being some marginal notes in the King James Bible, but they're specific. The purpose of them is very specific, and none of them are to interpret the text or give what James thinks are traitorous or seditious commentary on the verses.
Okay.
Opinions, yes. Okay. So, this decision is going to be completely consistent with his political ideology and philosophy that he outlined in The True Laws of Free Monarchies in Basil Adorno. And he doesn't want any of the seditious notes about undermining divine right of kings to end up in this, because does he absolutely believe in divine right of kings? Yes. So regarding this, David Norton writes, quote, he, James, may further have thought that by agreeing to the proposal would show him sympathetic to the Puritans while allowing him to strike a blow at the mainstay of their beliefs. He may also have thought that it would keep the leaders of all parts of the church busy and working together. Look, I know a lot of folks, they want to view this as sort of all this divine providential workings and God pulling all the strings and this and that. And I'm not saying that, you know, the Holy Spirit's not involved at all in any of this, but if you look at this for what it is, all of this is political. Okay? On the surface. Now, let's back up. On the surface, it might appear that James responded rashly to Reynolds' request. After all, the Puritans never mentioned prior to Hampton Court that they even desired a new translation of the Bible. How does one explain the swift and decisive nature of James's decision? So let's stop there. No one said a boo. No one has said a word about this. And then all of a sudden, Reynolds said, would it please the king to allow for a new translation? Then he goes through his whole thing about the great Bible and how it was poorly translated during the reigns of Edward and Henry. And he offers in its place three readings that are in the Geneva Bible. And the king says, yeah, we'll do that, but we're not going to have the marginal notes and this and that. And it, does it appear, if you're just backing up and looking at it, that James is making sort of a snap, rash decision here? In other words, there was nothing in the paperwork submitted to the king before the meeting that was even going to be a thing that what? That came up. And all the commentators say that Reynolds brought it up almost as a complete what? Afterthought. Right? But yet James makes a swift, decisive decision about this right there on the spot. Why would that be? Okay? So we want to look now at some historical context for James's decision. Actually, James was already of a mind that the English Bible needed to be retranslated before 1604. John Spotwood's History of the Church of England records that James favored a new translation of the Bible into English in a 1601 meeting of the General Assembly of the Scottish, of the Kirk, or the Church of Scotland. So, these events that we're talking about right now, they happened when? 1604. Back in 1601, when James is only the king of Scotland, there's a meeting of the Scottish Kirk. Scottish Church. Where the topic of the Bible comes up. So when James arrives at this moment in 1604, in his mind, is this something that's already been percolating for at least 3 years? You following that? Okay. So, here's what Spotswood said. Quote, a proposition was made for a new translation of the Bible and the correcting of the Psalms in meter. His Majesty did urge it earnestly, and with many reasons did persuade the undertaking of the work, showing the necessity and the profit of it, and what a glory the performing thereof should bring to this church. Speaking of necessity, he did mention sundry escapes in the common translation, and made it seem that he was no less conversant in the scriptures than they, whose profession it was. And when he came to speak of the Psalms, he did recite whole verses of the same, showing both the faults of the meter and the discrepancies from the text. It was the joy of all who were present to hear it, and bred not little admiration in the whole assembly, who approving the motion, did recommend the translation to such of the brethren as were most skilled in the languages and revising of the Psalms, particularly Mr. Robert Pont, but nothing was done Nothing was done in the one or the other. So understand, in 1601 is there a meeting of the Scottish Kirk. Does the topic come up that there needs to be a new translation of the Bible in English? Who steps to the fore and says yes, quotes from the Psalms, talks conversantly with the church leaders about the meter and readings in the Psalms, and gives his full stamp of approval to the idea of a new translation, and does the Scottish Kirk approve a motion to redo the English Bible in a meeting in 1601? So when James is now King of England in 1604, and Reynolds says, would it please the king for a new translation? James says, yes. Why? Because he's already been a part of a decision in 1601, while still King of Scotland, to make a new English Bible. So for James, this is not a new idea. This is an idea that he already had, that he was already involved in, a decision of the Scottish Kirk to do it, but nothing ever what? Nothing ever came of it. While nothing substantial was ever done with the Scottish resolution, Spotswood reports, quote, that the revising of the Psalms, he, James, made his own labor, and at such hours as he spent spare from public cares, he went through a number of them, commending the rest to the faithful and learned servant. So does James involve himself in the retranslation of... Oh, spilled the water. Does James involve himself in the retranslation of the Psalms? James's translation work on the Psalms was published in 1631 under the authorization of King Charles I. So, does James speak with authority on the Word of God in 1601 in a meeting of the Scottish Kirk? And does he go and retranslate some of the Psalms himself? His Psalms are published after his death in 1631 by his son. But my point is, they've already made this choice. So when the time comes here for the choice to be made, what seems like an afterthought to everybody else, has James already thought about this? Has he already made a decision about this? Has he already contributed retranslations of the Psalms to a project from when he was still King of Scotland? Okay? What this proves is that prior to Hampton Court in 1604, through his own study of the English Bible, he came to believe that it was not as it should be. Talking about James. This notion was no doubt solidified by his own translation work in the Psalms. Independent from any Puritan prodding, James had come to believe that the English Bible needed to be revised before Hampton Court in 1604. Consequently, when Reynolds floated the idea for a new translation, James seized the opportunity to do something that he already believed needed to be what? Done. You follow that? So in 1604, there's all these political considerations that we talked about up here. But before 1604, has he already been involved in a project in the Scottish Church to do this? And a motion is made and accepted to retranslate the Bible. Nothing ever comes of it. James does some of his own translation work in the Psalms. But now when you come to 1604 and Reynolds brings this up, James is like, has James already made up his mind that this needed to be done, irrespective of the footnotes in the Geneva Bible? That is another clue to me, folks, that James perceived what Reynolds wanted. Reynolds wanted the king to sanction what? The Geneva. And James does exactly what Nicholson says, yes, I'll give you what you want, but not the way you want it. And he conceives of a project now that will accomplish what he thought needed to be accomplished all the way back here in 1601, and it's going to be done the way he wants it to be what? Done. You following that? So, Spotswood, next point, Spotswood depicts James as having fulfilled his purpose from 1601 to, quote, perfect the English Bible via the translation of the King James. For James, this was the continuation of a process that began in 1601 during a meeting of the Church of Scotland. To this end, Spotswood states the following, quote, yet the king did not let his intention fall to the ground. After his happy coming to the crown of England, which with great pains and a singular prophet of the church, they what? Spotswood says that what the decision that's made here and what is ultimately put forth in 1611 is the perfection and the realization of an idea that James had where? Way back 10 years earlier. So when Reynolds brings it up, has James already thought about this? Has he already been involved in a decision? This is not a new thing to him. What seems to be this flippant request is something James has already what? Thought about. Now you wonder, would he have brought it up on his own if Reynolds hadn't mentioned it? We don't know. But Reynolds did mention it. And does he seize the opportunity, theologically, politically, and every other way, to get what he wants and control the way it happens? And give the Puritans exactly what they didn't want. You following this?
Mm-hmm.
So before moving off this point, it's important to note that at the 1601 meeting of the Church of Scotland, King James was merely agreeing with the proposition made. King James was merely agreeing with the proposition made by someone else calling for a new translation of the Bible. In addition, after much discussion, the motion was adopted by the Church of Scotland according to Spotswood. This proves that there were others, in addition to the king, who believed that the English Bible needed what?
Revising.
So now go back to 1601. James did not bring this up first. Somebody else did. And when somebody else brought it up, there's discussion around that topic that James what? Agrees with. Now this is an important point. So that tells you then that are there more people other than James who are looking at the situation with the English Bible back here and saying, you know, this really could be improved on. You follow me? Okay. A deeper look into the history of the English Bible before 1604 reveals that King James and the Church of Scotland were not the only ones clamoring for a new translation of the Bible into English. Historical evidence from the 1590s proves that a growing chorus of Bible-believing Christians within the English-speaking world had come to believe that a retranslation of the English Bible was in order and were calling for such a revision. We'll consider this evidence in the lesson next week. Okay? So, listen. To me, this is all absolutely fascinating, and this is the real story behind the decision. Reynolds wanted the Geneva. He cited three passages from the Great Bible and gave us corrections, the three readings that were already in the Geneva Bible. James smells out what Reynolds is after. In smelling it out, James already has made a decision before that a new Bible needed to be looked into, and now is it placed in his lap, the decision to do this. And so he is going to say, yeah, we'll do what you want. We're going to use the Bishop's Bible as the base text, and we're not going to have any of your seditious and traitorous marginal notes in this text. And then the result will be one Bible to be read and used by everybody in the realm, so to speak. Okay? All right, anybody got any questions or comments?
So, the work that James did that it says was published in 1631,
Reynolds had published.
His son published it after his dad died.
So
it was part of that copy and maybe not part of the translation?
Well, James's personal translations of the Psalms do not end up in the King James Bible.
Correct.
It's something he did on the side. But it's a point to say, was he involved in looking at this to a degree where he himself became convinced that something needed to be done? Yeah. And those, for his translations of the Psalms are published after his death.
Is it out there?
I'm sure it's out there. In fact, I need, that's one of the things on my list that I'm still trying to find. And if I can find it, I'm going to add a link to it in these notes. But yes, I believe it is out there and it is findable. I just haven't done it yet.
Gee, in your spare time?
So, anybody else have any questions about this?
Was their main
Who are we talking about?
Well, any of them. I mean,
so
like when I read the Bible, you know, I ask the good Lord, you know, let the truth be known to me. But I mean, to them, you know, were they seeking what God actually, you know, the actual what does God want, or did they? I mean, were they more worried about, you know, their divine kingship and more about?
So
you
know,
we want the Bible to say what we want, so that we can live the way we want.
So my answer to your question is yes. I think it's both. No one's going to say, none of them are going to say, oh, well, we don't care about accuracy and faithfulness to the text and a good translation. None of them are going to say that. But they all have their hat in the ring in one way or another. So this project now is going to force them to what?
Come together
and work on this project. So again, from that point of view, is it a brilliant political move for James? And can he still say, hey, I gave you that one thing you asked for. You asked me for that. I didn't give you anything else, but I gave you that. Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain that you're still not getting anything you want because my bishops are still controlling it, but we won't talk about that. So does James basically get everything he wants? I'm serious, like people don't realize how brilliant of a politician James is here. Okay? And why he's able to make such a quick decision. The reason he's able to make such a quick decision is because he already believed that needed to what? So Reynolds brings up this idea, it's not on the millenary petition, it's not on the agenda submitted to the king, and he's like, sure, let's do that. We'll do it my way, but we'll do it. So Dan, to your original question, the answer is yes, they care about both. And that's what you would hope this would bring forth. Okay? And that's why I said last Sunday, when this thing comes off the press in 1611, it's not immediately like, oh, finally, the one Bible we can all agree on. It took some time for it to establish that level of respect, so to speak. So there's a lot to all of this, and I'm like, to me, when I was studying this, and I realized that when it came to this point here, and James makes a decision, and I understood why he made the decision, and the context he made the decision, and what's all going into that decision, etc. And Bancroft, his soon-to-be Archbishop of Canterbury, when he first hears it, he's like, "No way!" I'm paraphrasing, but he's like, "If you guys, every man had his humor, there'd be no end to translating." He's totally against it. But James wasn't. And why would he not? Why would he not be totally against it if it's a new idea to him? The truth is, it's not a new idea to him. And he's already been involved in a discussion 3 years before in the Scottish Church to do the exact thing now that Reynolds may have been, and again, I know I'm repeating myself a lot here just to reiterate the point, but I absolutely believe that when Reynolds brought it up, this is what he wanted. He wanted the king to just say, yep, you guys can read your Geneva Bible in church. The king was not going to allow it. So he says, yeah, I'll give you what you want. I love the way Nicholson says that. Let me find that quote again. Yes, I'll give you the opposite of what you want. And it's all absolutely brilliant politics from the point of view of James.
And using the bishop's Bible as a starting point, that was a brilliant move too, because it gave the church what it wanted, the bishops.
It gave the bishops what they wanted.
But he knew that Bible needed translation.
He knew it needed revision.
Yeah.
So the King James Bible is not a new translation. It is a revision of the bishop's Bible. Okay? So many people have totally misconceived this. They did not start with a blank page to retranslate. They started with a 1602 Bishop's Bible as their base text. And I'm going to talk about this with you next week because that's what rule number one said. Okay? In England, there is a document in the Bodleian Library called Bod 1602, which is a 1602 Bishop's Bible with the handwritten notations of the translators in the margin, where they crossed that word out and wrote a new word in. And then somebody else came by and they said, no, we don't like that word, we're switching it back. Or we're going to add a third word instead. And you can literally follow their first, second, and third stage revisions by looking at the notations in a 1602 Bishop's Bible. Okay? So there's a folk tale that has circulated in King James only literature that they didn't follow rule number one. Okay? To follow the Bishop's Bible. And the reason why is because fundamental Baptists who are King James only don't like the idea that this Bible that they think is the final authority is so close to High Church Anglicanism. So Peter Ruckman and others, I'll show you the quote once already, I'll show you again next Sunday, where they say that they didn't follow rule one. Hogwash, utter rubbish, not true. In fact, rule one, I think, is the rule they followed more than any other rule. And we have the documents to prove it. Where you can take, I've made videos about this, where you can take a bishop's Bible, look at the pictures, see where they crossed this word out, crossed that word out, added the words in, and you can see that when you compare what they crossed out and what they added in, you can see them transforming the Bishop's Bible into the King James Bible by their annotations.
But a lot of what they ended up with was more similar to the Geneva.
In the percentage of the text that they changed, a high percentage of the changes made changes to Genevan readings. That is true. But the text that they're using as the base text is the bishop's text. So there's a percentage of changes that are going to come. So in the instances where they change the bishops, a percentage of the changes are going to come from the bishop, I'm sorry, from the Geneva, a percentage are going to come from the Reims. Remember, we studied this already, and I know this is another thing a lot of people don't like, but the Reams, there are Reams readings in a King James Bible. This is indisputable fact. It's objective. Go look at my lesson from last May when I talked about this. Okay?
But the changes are for readability and understandability, not doctrine.
The changes are because they feel a word or a phrase is more in line with the original text the way the Geneva said it. None of the marginal notes from the Geneva are going to make it into a King James. The text, we're talking about the biblical text, not the ancillary stuff. Okay? Alright, next Sunday we're going to talk about the rules that are going to then be given to the translator. So my point was to lay out for you what's really going on with James, why he makes this decision, what Reynolds really wanted, and the fact that Bancroft opposed it. Last thing I want to say is this. Guess who's going to now... So who's the guy when the request is floated for a new translation, who's the guy who immediately opposed it? Bancroft. Right? Guess who's going to be the guy who writes the rules? Bancroft. Is Bancroft another politician? He wants to be the Archbishop of Canterbury, and now that the king has said yes, can he endear himself to the king by being the guy who oversees this? Okay? Listen, the truth is way more interesting than stuff that's been said. But we gotta quit, so thanks for your attention.
Now, is Bancroft one of the Puritans?
No.